How can faith and reason work together? Are they somehow mutually exclusive? What role do facts and evidence play in the Christian faith? This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and today we're talking about Islam. Do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? And I want to remind you that there are many resources just like this podcast available at reasonablefaith.org. Transcripts and recordings of Dr. Craig's debates on college campuses around the world, articles, questions and answers, a discussion forum, and much more. Available now at reasonablefaith.org. Dr. Craig, on top of everybody's mind these days is the subject of Islam. There are a bunch of reasons for that. The atrocities of 9/11, some of the prominence in the world and wars and so forth. So now more than ever, we seem to be more aware of Islam than in recent memory.
Well, I think that we shouldn't underestimate what George Bush Sr. called the change in the New World Order that took place with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The central geopolitical reality used to be this opposition between the West, the democratic democracies, and then the Soviet bloc countries dominated by Marxism. And the dissolution of the Soviet Union really, really did result in a new world order. And what's happened in the aftermath of that is that it's resulted in the so-called clash of civilizations between the Muslim world and the democratic West. And so that, I think, is also a contributing factor, along with the obvious terrorist attacks and immigration into Western nations, especially in Europe like France and England and the Netherlands. This has all served to raise the profile of Islam in our day and age in a way that, gosh, just 30 years ago, it wasn't even on the radar screen. It
didn't seem to be. And we've discussed the new atheism in some of our broadcasts. Mm. And a lot of those books that are bestsellers these days are a reaction to the terrorist attacks and to Islam and saying, this is what religion produces. Yes. That's why faith and religion need to be eradicated.
Exactly. That's the difference with the new atheism, by the way, is that they are not content simply to remove religion from the public square like normal secularists think, but they want it eradicated from society altogether. I fear what would happen if these people ever got into power, because they would be ruthless, I think, in attempting to exterminate religious belief. And a lot of this is prompted, as you say, by radical Islam. And unfortunately, we as Christians get lumped into the mix along with radical Muslims as part of the enemy to be exterminated.
As I look at the issue, Bill, it seems that there is the theological issue Christians would deal with, and that is the difference in the denial of Jesus as who he claimed to be. But then there's also the political ramifications of their very strict enforcement of their laws and their hatred of the West. And so we seem to have a two-prong attack there, one political and one theological. Let's deal with both.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. On the one hand, there are the profound theological differences between our concepts of God as well as our concept of Christ, our doctrines of salvation, our doctrine of sin. All of those are different in Islam and Christianity. But then also on the political front, you've got, for example, the fact that the U.S. is deeply aligned with the state of Israel, and these Muslim nations are committed for the most part to the elimination of Israel, or at least to being enemies with Israel. And so that political reality has also poisoned relations between Muslims and Westerners.
What Westerners often try to do is to be real tolerant here and say, look, we're both worshiping the same God. We're just calling him different names.
Yeah, I'm just astonished at that. I remember shortly after the terrorist attacks in New York City, Secretary of State Colin Powell was interviewed, and he said, no great world religion espouses murder. And I thought, Secretary Powell, have you never read the ninth surah in the Quran, where it enjoins ambush, attack, lying in wait for the unbelievers and exterminating them? It was evident that for him, it was just inconceivable that some great world religion wouldn't hold the same values that we hold dear and cherish. And the fact is, it's not one world. There really are different religions that have vastly different value systems than we in the West hold as a result of the influence of Christianity.
God and the God of the Bible, the God of Jesus, and Allah seem to have different properties.
Yes, and Muslims recognize that as well. A faithful Muslim would be just as offended as a conservative Christian in saying, for example, that God is the Father of Jesus Christ. I remember in the aftermath of 9/11 at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., one of the ministers began his prayer by saying, God of Abraham, God of Muhammad, Father of Jesus Christ. And I thought to myself, that offends all the Muslims in the audience as well as Christians, because for a Muslim to say that God is the Father of Jesus Christ is blasphemous. This is to commit the most heinous sin possible in Islam, which is the sin called shirk, which means associating something with God, putting something else on the same level as God. For the Muslim, God is without peer. He is incomparable. And therefore, to say that he has a son is to demean God's status as the incomparable, peerless one. And so they condemn unequivocally anybody who believes that Jesus is God's son.
So immediately there is such an emotional resistance when there is a dialogue that takes place between Christians and Muslims. It's hard to overcome. To say that God is triune is so offensive and so radical to their sensibilities that it's difficult for them to hear anything else after you've said that.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it does touch deep nerves that create anger and resentment. And so it is very difficult to dialogue about these things in a civil way.
Let me tell you what's been successful in my own experience, and I'll get your comments on it. But I usually start out when I've talked to some Muslim friends, and this actually keeps the emotional wall from coming up too quickly. But I'll say, you know, both you and I believe that there is one God. I believe it, and you believe it. Now, we believe there's something else about God that we call the Trinity, but we both believe, and I'll reiterate, in one God. Now, that seems to calm things down a little bit and at least give me an opportunity to perhaps explain the Trinity within the oneness of God and so on. But at the same time, I try not to get bogged down on the Trinity. I try to get them to Jesus.
Yeah.
But the Trinity is going to come up.
Sure. But I think you're right, Kevin, is to focus on Jesus. He's the stumbling block, and he's the one I think that we need to draw them to and to talk about what the Quran says about Jesus. It says that he was a great prophet. It even calls him the Messiah. He was born of a virgin. He did miracles. He's coming again. So in all of these ways, Islam has an exalted view of Jesus, but it doesn't rise to divinity, obviously. And so I think we can focus on Jesus, and what we should not do is start attacking Muhammad as a person or calling Muslims terrorists or criticizing the religion in other ways. I think we can be positive and focus upon Jesus and who Jesus was and what he claimed and did. And that's really where the whole issue should be. It should be on Christ.
So let's sum that up then. If our Muslim friends ask us about the Trinity, we might can kind of give an answer like I just said. Try to establish something that's going to knock down the emotional wall, that we both believe in one God.
Right.
That should settle some nerves. But then try to get it to Jesus as soon as we can, because that will help facilitate later talk about the Trinity once we establish some of Jesus.
Yes, I think that's right. And we shouldn't forget that the Holy Spirit is at work here, and the Holy Spirit came to glorify Christ and to draw men to him. So when we're talking about Christ, the Holy Spirit is also at work, I think, in drawing people to him. That's his role. So when we focus on Christ, I think we're right at the heart of the gospel.
That is good. There seem to be what we would consider as liberal Muslims who really do want to see some unity among the West and the Islam world.
We want to encourage moderate Muslims who are, as you say, frankly, liberals with respect to their religion. People who adopt, I think, a very non-Islamic stance, namely that church and state should be separate, or mosque and state, we might say. In Orthodox Islam, They know nothing of the separation of church and state. Religion and state are all united under the dominance of the religion. But in many Muslim states today, such as Egypt and Jordan and Turkey, you have a separation, in effect, of church and state and a government that is secular and the mosque operates independently of it. And that's the kind of thing that we want to keep encouraging and, as you say, keep growing, and because that will help to, I think, quell the fanaticism of the Orthodox Muslim fundamentalists. But I must say that so long as the United States is aligned with Israel and continues to support Israel, I really am not hopeful that there's going to be an end to this conflict politically. And I don't think that the U.S. can back away from Israel. It's a democracy, one of the few democracies in that area. And I think we have every reason to continue to support Israel. It's been a great ally. And as long as we do that, it's hard to see, frankly, that a whole lot of progress and goodwill is going to be generated.
At reasonablefaith.org, you have some transcripts and some audio of some debates with some prominent Muslim scholars. Give us a thumbnail of some of these debates. How have they gone, and what are some of the issues that come up?
It's been such a tremendous privilege and excitement to be involved in these debates. By way of background, when I was doing my theological doctorate in Munich, I had to pick a couple of side areas on which to be examined. And one of the side areas that I picked was Islam, because I had been interested in medieval Muslim theology and philosophy. And so naturally, I wanted to specialize more in Islamic thought. So I studied Islam extensively and then was examined in it. Well, at that time, I never dreamt that someday I would be speaking and debating on this subject. But in the aftermath of 9/11, I've had the opportunity to debate Muslim apologists like Jamal Badawi and Shabir Ali on Canadian and American university campuses. And what I found is that the Muslim student associations on university campuses are extremely active in bringing in these Muslim speakers like Badawi and Ali to do Muslim evangelism and encourage the Muslim students there to hold to the faith. And it's interesting, their reaction or their approach is inevitably very rational. These Muslim apologists are strongly rational and apologetical in their approach to Islam and Christianity. And some of them know the Bible better than most Christians do, frankly. They quote chapter and verse from memory. They're familiar with the Jesus Seminar and other biblical critics and exploit the work of people like this. They will often like to say even Christian scholars deny that Jesus ever said this, and then they'll quote these liberal Jesus Seminar critics and so forth. So I've had the chance to debate these fellows, and it's been very exciting to do so, because what I find in dealing with them is that in talking with a Muslim, it's very much like talking with a radical biblical critic, because they basically say the same thing, that Jesus never really said these things, that these are later claims that were invented by the Christian church and then put back onto the lips of Jesus. And so you're basically involved in the same apologetic to a Muslim that you are to one of these liberal critics. You want to use the so-called criteria of authenticity to try to show that certain sayings and events attributed to Jesus in the Gospels were in fact really said by him, and therefore they cannot be regarded as later corruptions of the oral tradition. These claims were actually made by Jesus. And since the Muslim regards Jesus as a prophet who speaks for God, if he really said these things, then they have to believe him. They have to believe what Jesus claimed about himself. And so that's why I like to really focus on the claims of Christ and then, of course, on his resurrection.
As I understand, some of these debates have actually turned pretty emotional with the opponent. And that just kind of shows that these are some emotional issues from time
to
time.
Yeah, you know, most of them, almost all of them, were very calm, very civil. Shabir Ali, in particular, is a thorough gentleman. He is everybody, all the Christian apologists I know who've debated Shabir like this guy on a personal level. We call him by his first name, Shabir, you know, he's very friendly. Everybody really, really likes him. So he's always conducts himself very well in these debates, though he's slippery as an eel and very sly. He's very wily. You got to watch out for him or he'll pick your pocket, so to speak, when you're not looking. But I was in a debate with Jamal Badawi at Texas A&M, and to my surprise, he just became unhinged. And particularly when I made the remark that I didn't think this would get under his skin, but I made the remark that in the Quran, it doesn't actually say that Abraham sacrificed Ishmael on the altar. Muslims believe it was Ishmael, not Isaac, that Abraham laid on the altar to sacrifice at God's command. And in fact, when you read the Quran, that's not what it says. It says it's Isaac. And I thought, how odd that Islam believes this about Ishmael when in the Quran it says it was Isaac. And so I just happened to mention this in the debate. And he just went off the charts. He began interrupting and speaking out of turn and, you know, protesting, trying to explain this away and so forth. And it was obvious that it touched a real nerve. And I suppose because it strikes right at the heart of who you are as a Muslim, that it is Ishmael that is the promised child. And therefore, it's they who are really the chosen people. And I just had no idea that it would do that. For me, it was just an off-the-cuff remark, but It really shows something.
It shows how ingrained this is. You're attacking family heritage. You're attacking culture. You're attacking their religion, way of life. Just like a Christian, just very deeply ingrained. And in some ways, maybe Islam is even more of a cultural.
Oh, absolutely. You know. Because it is a whole way of life. I mean, for Orthodox Islam, as I said, there is no separation of church and state. Everything is under the domination of the religion, the government, the banking system, social mores, education, everything has to be brought into submission to Allah. That's what Islam means, submission. And a Muslim is one who is in submission in every area of his life. So, I mean, in one sense, Muslims have a lot to teach us as Christians about total submission to God. I think as Christians, we are called upon Romans 12:1-2. To be totally sold out to God, body and soul, laid on his altar as living sacrifices. And in that sense, we, I think, agree with the Muslim in this notion that we are to be, in our lives personally, totally submitted to God. But they extend it beyond the personal life to society as a whole, and they're submitted to a quite different God. That's the problem.
The Christian will often say, one of the evidences for the truth of Christianity is look how it spread after the crucifixion, after the resurrection. The skeptic will come back and say, well, then how do you explain the spread of Islam and how popular that has become?
Right. And for that reason, I don't think that that's a good argument for Christianity. One could also point out Mormonism, which has, in the 100 or so years since Joseph Smith lived, has spread to become really a new world religion. Mormonism is emerging as a new world religion, in addition to Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, and so forth. So the fact that Christianity spread quickly in the Mediterranean world and then even beyond isn't a good argument for its truth. I think that the germ of truth in that argument is the following, and this is what I've used in my own work. What is to be explained about Christianity is not its rapid spread, but its very origin. Christianity had its origin in the belief of these earliest disciples that God had raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. Now, that is a totally un-Jewish belief, not to say an outlandish belief. How do you explain the origin of that belief on the disciples' part? And I think when you look at the possible explanations, namely, it's a Christian retrojection, or it's from pagan mythology, or it's from Jewish influences, none of those provides a plausible explanation of why the disciples came to believe such an un-Jewish and outlandish thing as that God raised Jesus from the dead, so that the very origin of the Christian movement cries out for some sort of an explanation in the fact of the resurrection itself. And one could use a similar argument for Islam, that given the origin of Islam in the mid-7th century AD, there must have been some historical events that brought it about. And I think that's quite true. There must have been a historical Muhammad who probably had some kind of a vision of God, who was offended by polytheism and began to proclaim that there is only one true God. So that's right. I think it applies in both cases, that you have to have a historically adequate cause to explain the sudden origin of a movement that is quite different from anything that preceded it.
One of the differences between the spread of Christianity and the spread of Islam seems to be the sword.
Well, yeah, that's true, I guess.
Do you want to mention that?
Well, yeah, that's worth mentioning, isn't it? I mean, Christianity, during the first 3 centuries of its existence, was this tiny, persecuted religion that often was punctuated by horrible martyrdoms. Its growth was watered by the blood of these martyrs. By contrast, Islam was spread by military conquest. Just 2 years after the death of Muhammad, the Arabian forces invaded Persia and brought it into submission. Then Syria fell a year or so later. Then Jerusalem fell. And after that, Egypt. And then these Islamic armies swept right across North Africa all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. So it was by conquest that Islam was spread. And this is part of the doctrine of Islam. As I mentioned earlier in the 9th chapter of the Quran, it enjoins violence against pagans in order to bring them into submission, and even violence against the so-called people of the book, that is to say Jews and Christians, until they are brought into submission too. Islam, Kevin, divides the whole world into 2 camps. One is called the Dar al-Islam, and the other is called the Dar al-Harb. And that means the house of submission. Those are the lands or nations that are brought into submission to Islam. The house of submission, the other, is called the house of war. And those are the lands that have not yet been brought into submission to Islam. And this perception of the world is in these 2 camps, the house of submission, the house of war, speaks volumes about the nature of Islam and its command to bring the world by force, if necessary, into submission to Allah.
In summation, Dr. Craig, we don't worship the same God. We don't agree theologically on the nature of God, but we want to try to get Jesus front and center in his claims when we deal with Islam.
That's exactly right. Paul, in preaching the gospel, said, "I determined to know nothing among you except for Jesus Christ and him crucified." And just as that was folly to Gentiles and a stumbling block to Jews, it is also the stumbling block for Muslims as well. And therefore, like Paul, we need to point our hearers, when they're Muslims, to the person of Christ.
Our question of the day, Dr. Craig, are Christianity and science compatible?
Well, I'm persuaded that they are compatible. Certainly, there are areas of conflict that do arise from time to time. But I think that in the course of time, these conflicts will be resolved. And so in various areas that I've worked on, such as relativity theory and cosmology, there I think one sees that a religious perspective on these issues can shed real light on science. I think that religion can learn from science, and I think that science can learn from religion, so that there are a number of ways in which these two interact with each other that can be helpful.
Science is not the only way to gain knowledge. Many people think that that's the case.
That's a really good point. I think that that is not science. That's scientism, the view that only through scientific exploration can knowledge be gained. That itself is not a scientific claim. That is a philosophical claim, so that it would be self-defeating if it were made. The very claim that you can only know truth through science isn't a scientifically provable claim. So it would be self-defeating. There are other avenues to truth besides science, and there are other types of knowledge besides scientific knowledge, such as mathematical knowledge, logical knowledge, ethical knowledge, aesthetic knowledge, metaphysical knowledge. Even many scientific truths cannot be proven scientifically. So while science is one avenue to truth, and perhaps the best way to find out truth about the empirical world, nevertheless, there's lots of truth that is not scientifically accessible that we can know by other means.
And Dr. Craig, there is a fear of science, even among people who think that science is the only way to truth, and it shows up in science fiction movies, and that is that science, or the advance of science and scientific discoveries, can be used against man.
This is because science is ethically neutral. You cannot discover moral values in a test tube. So science is amoral. That's not to say it's immoral. It's amoral. It's simply morally neutral. so that the same scientific discovery that can be used to fuel nuclear reactors and light a city can be used to make a bomb that could destroy that city. And that's why we mustn't simply leave science unchecked by ethical considerations. We cannot allow science to just do whatever is scientifically possible. There need to, I think, be ethical and moral considerations upon what we allow science to do.
For more resources like these from Dr. William Lane Craig, go to reasonablefaith.org. That's reasonablefaith.org.